Chapter 6. The boat crew was watching for Austin to pop out of the water and snagged him like a runaway calf. Within minutes, he was back on the deck where he spelled out the situation for Becker and Captain Larson. "Dear God," Becker said, "what a terrible way to die. My government will spare no expense to retrieve their bodies for the families." Becker's pessimism was starting to annoy Austin. "Please stop playing the role of the melancholy Dane, Mr. Becker. Your government can hold on to its wallet. Those men aren't dead yet." "But you said..." "I know what I said. They're in tough shape, but that doesn't mean they're doomed. The Squalus submarine rescue took more than a day to accomplish, and 33 were saved." Austin paused as his sharp ears picked up a new sound. He stared at the sky and shaded his eyes against the glare of the overcast. "Looks like the cavalry has arrived." A gigantic helicopter was bearing down on the ship. Dangling below the helicopter in a sling was a blimp-shaped submarine with a blunt nose. "That's the largest helicopter I've ever seen," Captain Larson said.
"Actually, the MI-26 is the biggest helicopter in the world," Austin said. "It's more than 100 feet long. They call it the Flying Crane."
Becker smiled for the first time in hours.
"Please tell me that strange-looking object hanging below the helicopter is your rescue vehicle."
"The Sea Lamprey isn't the prettiest craft in the sea," Izavala said with a shrug. "I sacrificed form for function in designing her."
"To the contrary," Becker said. "She's beautiful."
The captain shook his head in wonderment. "How on earth did you get this equipment here so quickly? You were 1,200 miles away when the rescue call went out."
"We remembered that the Russians like to do things in a big way," Austin said. "They jumped at the chance to show the world they're still a first-rate nation."
"But that helicopter couldn't have carried it all that way in such a short time. You gentlemen must be magicians."
"It took a lot of work to pull this rabbit out of a hat," Austin said as he watched the helicopter maneuver. The MI-26 picked up the submersible at sea and transferred it to a land base, where two Antonov N-124 heavy-duty transport planes were waiting. The Sea Lamprey went on one plane. The big chopper and the Numa helicopter were loaded on the other. It was a 2-hour flight to the NATO base in the Faroes. "While they unloaded the submersible and got it ready to fly, we came out here to prepare the way." The powerful turboshaft engines drowned out the captain's reply as the aircraft moved closer and hovered. The 8-rotor blades and 5-bladed tail rotor threshed the air, and the downdraft they created scooped a vast, watery crater out of the sea. The submersible was released a few feet above the roiling water, and the helicopter moved off. The Sea Lamprey had been fitted out with large, air-filled pontoons. It sank beneath the waves, but quickly bobbed back to the surface.
Austin suggested that the captain ready the sickbay to treat extreme hypothermia.
Then the boat crew ferried them out to the submersible. The launch crew detached the pontoons. The submersible blew air from its ballast tanks and sank below the blue-black surface. The Sea Lamprey hovered, kept at an even keel by its thrusters. Austin and Zavala sat in the snug cockpit, their faces washed by the blue light from the instrument panel, and ran down the dive checklist. Then Zavala pushed the control stick forward, angled the blunt prow down, and blew ballast. He steered the submersible in a descending spiral as casually as if he were taking the family out on a Sunday drive. Austin peered into the gauzy bluish blackness beyond the range of the lights. "I didn't have time to ask you before we came aboard," he said, almost an afterthought. "Is this thing safe?"
"As a former president once said, it depends on your definition of is."
Austin groaned.
"Let me rephrase my question. Are the leaks and the pump fixed?"
"I think I stopped up the leaks, and the ballast pump works well under ideal conditions.
What about actual conditions? Kurt, my father used to quote an old Spanish proverb, "The closed mouth swallows no flies."
What the hell do flies have to do with our situation?
Nothing, Zavala said. I just thought we should change the subject. Maybe the problem with the ballast control will go away.
The vehicle had been built as a rescue system of last resort. Once its lasers punched a hole in a sunken vessel, water would rush in after the sub disengaged. There was no way to plug the opening. All trapped crewmen had to be evacuated in one trip. This was a prototype built to carry only 8 people, plus a pilot and co-pilot. If all 13 men were taken off the cruiser, they'd be over the weight limit by 5. Austin said, I've been running the figures in my head. Estimate 150 pounds per man, and we've got more than a ton of weight. There's a safety margin built into the Lamprey, so it's probably no big whoop, except for the lame ballast tank. No problem. We've got a backup pump if the main isn't working. In designing the Sea Lamprey, Zavala had followed common practice and built redundant systems. Zavala paused. Some of the crew might be dead.
I've been thinking about that, Austin said. We'd increase our safety margin if we left bodies down there, but I'm not leaving until we've got every man aboard, dead or alive. The cockpit grew silent as both men considered the awful possibilities. The only sound was the hum of electric motors as the ungainly craft dropped into the depths. Before long, they were at the side of the cruiser. Austin directed Zavala to the penetration point. Then came a soft clunk as the front end of the submersible bumped the curved steel plates. Electric pump motors hummed and the submersible stayed where it was, glued to the steel by a vacuum.
The escape tunnel, made of a tough but pliable synthetic material, was extended. 8 vertical and horizontal thrusters kept the vehicle steady under the direction of computers that monitored its movement in relation to the current.
The instruments indicated when the seal was complete.
Normally, a thin probe would penetrate the hull to look for explosive fumes. Sensors gauged the pressure within the seal and kept the vacuum in place. Given the safe signal to enter, Austin strapped on a small air tank and a scuba regulator and emerged from the airlock. There was some leakage around the seal, but not enough to worry about. He started to crawl through the escape tunnel. Inside the cruiser, the crew and captain had slipped into a death-like sleep. Captain Peterson was roused from his cold slumber by the sound of a giant woodpecker. Damned bird! While one level of his brain cursed the source of the noise, another was automatically analyzing it, grouping the raps into familiar patterns, each the equivalent of a letter. Hello. He flicked the torch on. The chef had heard the noise and his eyes were as big as fried eggs. The captain's stiff fingers groped for the wrench by his side and banged it weakly against the hull. Then again, with more force. The reply was immediate. Move away. More easily said than done, the captain thought. Peterson told the chef to back off from the bulkhead, then followed, rolling out of his bunk. He crawled across the deck and called out to the other men to move. He sat with his back to a locker for what seemed an eternity, not sure what to expect. Austin crawled back into the Lamprey. Mission accomplished, he said. Turning on the can opener, Zavala said. He hit the switch for the ring of cutting lasers. They sliced through the 2-inch metal skin as easily as a paring knife through an orange. A monitor showed the penetration and the brilliant red of the lasers. The lasers automatically shut off. Peterson had been watching as a faint pink circle deepened in color until it was a bright, molten reddish-orange. He felt welcome heat against his face. There was a hollow clang as a section of the hull fell into the cabin, and he had to shield his eyes against a bright disk of light. Steam filled the escape tunnel, and the edges of the opening were still hot from the laser cutters. Austin pushed a specially made ladder over the rim and stuck his head through the opening. "Any of you gentlemen call a taxi?" he said. Despite his light-hearted manner, Austin wondered if the rescue was too late. He had never seen such a bedraggled bunch. He called out for Captain Peterson. A grease-covered apparition crawled forward and croaked, "I'm the captain." "Who are you?" Austin climbed into the ship and helped the captain to his feet. "The introductions will have to wait. Please tell your men who can still move to crawl through that hole." The captain translated the order. Austin threw a couple of soggy blankets onto the rough edges of the opening, then helped those who couldn't make it under their own power. Peterson collapsed as he was trying to crawl into the submersible, and Austin had to give him a shove, then clambered in behind him. As he entered the airlock, he saw water trickling in through the rim of the seal where Zavala had done a hasty patch job. He quickly closed the hatch behind him. Zavala had put the controls on auto while he pulled the crew through the airlock. The bulky survival suits didn't make the task any easier. It was a miracle that any of the crew was still alive. Amazingly, some had made the trip themselves. The passenger space consisted of two padded benches running the length of the sub, separated by a narrow aisle. The survivors crowded onto the benches or stood in the aisle like commuters on a Tokyo subway. "Sorry there's no first class section," Austin said.
"No complaint," said the captain. "My men will agree that it is better than our former living arrangements."
With the crew settled, Kurt returned to the cockpit.
"We had a little leakage around the seal," he reported.
Zavala indicated a blinking light on a computer-generated diagram of the submersible.
"More than a little. The O-ring blew out like a flat tire a second after we closed the airlock."
He retracted the telescopic escape tub, disengaged the submersible from the dead ship, and backed off, clearly revealing in its floodlights the round hole where the lasers had cut out the escape route. When they were clear of the wreck, he activated the ballast pumps. The electric motors clicked into action with a low hum, except from the front right pump, where there was a sound like a fork going down a garbage disposal. One ballast tank still had water in it, disrupting the sub's equilibrium as the others filled with compressed air. The Sea Lamprey operated like any other submarine. It pumped water into its ballast tanks to dive, pumped in air to ascend. The computer tried to compensate by giving more power to the vertical thrusters. The submersible lurched into nose-down angle, and the smell of hot metal came through the vents. Zavala pumped water back into the other tanks, and the Lamprey leveled out, more or less. Austin stared at the instrument panel. A light was blinking on a schematic troubleshooting diagram. He ran a check on the computer that served as the brains of the vehicle. The trouble system indicated that the warning light had been triggered by an actual mechanical problem, the kind of glitch that could show up with new equipment and probably easily repairable. But this was not a test run. It was a deep submergence dive to 50 fathoms. Another light started blinking red. "Both front motors are gone," Austin said. "Better use the backup pumps."
"Those were the backup pumps," Zavala said.
"So much for redundant systems.
What's the problem?"
"I could tell you in a minute if I had this thing up on a lift."
"I don't see any garages nearby, and in any case, I forgot my credit card."
"As my father used to say, all it takes to move a stubborn burro is a stick of dynamite," Zavala said. Around the halls of Numa, Austin had a well-deserved reputation for an unflappable stubbornness in the face of adversity. Most men wisely cut and run in the face of sure disaster. Austin faced it with equanimity. The fact that he was still alive and breathing showed that he possessed a remarkable combination of resourcefulness and luck. Those who'd had to tough it out with him found his serendipity frightening. Austin always shrugged off their complaints. But now Joe was giving him a taste of his own medicine. Austin compressed his lips in a tight smile, laced his fingers behind his head, and sat back in his seat. You wouldn't be so relaxed if you didn't have a plan, Austin said. Zavala gave his partner an exaggerated wink and removed the two-pronged key that had been hanging from a chain around his neck. He flipped open a small metal cap in the center of the console and inserted the key. When I turned this key and flicked the little switch next to it, the third redundant system comes into play. Explosive charges will blow off all the ballast tanks, and up we go. Smart, eh? Not if the Thor is in the way when we come flying out of the water. We'd sink the ship and us. If it makes you feel any better, press that button. It sends up a warning buoy to the surface. Flares, whistles, the whole nine yards. Austin punched the button. There was a swoosh as the buoy was ejected from the sub. He advised their passengers to hold tight. Zavala jerked his thumb skyward, a boyish grin on his face. Going up! He hit the switch and they braced themselves. The only sound was Zavala swearing under his breath in Spanish. The switch didn't work, he said with a sheepish grin. Let's see if I can summarize this. We're 300 feet down, with overloaded capacity, the cabin full of half-dead sailors, and the panic button doesn't work.
You have a knack for brevity, Kurt.
Thanks. I'll expand further. We've got two front tanks full of water, two rear ones empty, and that spells neutral buoyancy. Any way of lightening the lamprey?
I can jettison the connector tube.
We'll get to the surface, but it won't be pretty. Doesn't seem we have much of an alternative. I'll tell our passengers to hold on. Austin made his announcement, buckled himself into his seat, and gave the signal. Zavala crossed his fingers and blew off the rescue tube. It had been made detachable as a precaution in case the submersible had to extricate itself from a rescue in a hurry. There was a muffled explosion and the submersible lurched. As the water was expelled from the rear tanks, the sea lamprey rose a foot, then a yard, then several yards. Their progress was excruciatingly slow at first, but the craft gained more speed the higher it went. Before long, it was speeding to the surface. The sea lamprey exploded from the sea stern first and splashed down in a fountain of white water. The vehicle rolled violently, tossing those inside around like dice in a shaker. Alerted by the warning buoy's sound and light show, small boats dashed in and their crews attached pontoons that stabilized the craft in a more or less horizontal position. The Thor got a line on the vehicle and hauled the sea lamprey close to where a crane could lift it to the deck. Medical personnel swarmed over the submersible the second the hatch was popped, and the survivors were extracted one by one, loaded onto stretchers and hustled onto waiting medevac helicopters that transferred them to the land hospital. By the time Austin and Zavala climbed from the submersible, the deck was practically deserted, except for a handful of crew who came over and congratulated them, then quickly left. Zavala looked around the near-empty deck.
No brass band?
Heroism is its own reward, Austin said pontifically. But I wouldn't turn down a shot of tequila if someone offered it to me.
What a coincidence. I just happened to have a bottle of blue agave tucked away in my duffel bag.
Primo stuff. We may have to delay our celebration. Mr. Becker is coming our way. The Danish bureaucrat was striding across the deck, his face beaming with unmistakable happiness. He pumped their hands, pounded the Numa men on the back, and showered them with effusive praise.
Gentlemen, I thank you, he said breathlessly. Denmark thanks you. The world thanks you.
Our pleasure, Austin said. Thanks for the opportunity to test the sea lamprey under actual conditions. The Russian chopper is at the NATO base with the transport planes. We'll give them a call, and we can be out of here in a few hours. Becker's face reassumed its usual mask of businesslike dourness.
Mr. Zavala is free to go, but I'm afraid you might have to delay your trip. A special investigative court formed to look into the cruiser incident is convening a hearing in Tórshavn tomorrow. They would like you to testify.
Don't see how I can help. I didn't see the actual sinking.
Yes, but you dove on the Ericsson twice. You can describe the damage in detail. It will help make our case.
Seeing the doubt in Austin's face, he said, I'm afraid we'll have to insist that you be our guests in the islands until the hearing is terminated.
Cheer up. The U.S. Embassy has been informed of our request and will transmit it to Numa. I've already arranged lodging for you. We'll be staying in the same hotel, in fact. The islands are beautiful, and you'll only be delayed a day or two before you can rejoin your ship.
It's no problem for me, Kurt, Zavala said. I can get the Lamprey back to the BB and wrap up the tests.
Austin's eyes flashed with anger. He didn't like being told what to do by an officious little government drone. He made no effort to disguise the annoyance in his voice.
Looks like I'll be your guest, Mr. Becker.
He turned to Zavala. We'll have to put off our celebration. I'll call the NATO base and get things moving. Before long, the engine roar of the huge Russian helicopter filled the air. The sling was attached under the sea lamprey's belly, and the helicopter lifted the vehicle from the ship's deck. Then Zavala took off in the Numa helicopter and followed the submersible back to the base, where the sub would be loaded on a transport plane for the return trip.
One other thing, Becker said. I'd like you to keep that remarkable suit on board in case the court has the need for further evidence. If not, we'll gladly ship it anywhere you wish.
You want me to make another dive?
Possibly. I would clear it with your superiors, of course.
Of course, Austin said. He was too tired to argue.
The captain came over and announced that the shuttle was ready to take them back to the mainland. Austin wasn't enthusiastic about spending any more time than he had to with the Danish bureaucrat. I'll come ashore tomorrow, if it's all right with you.
Captain Larson wants to show me some of the results of his whale research.
The captain saw the desperation in Austin's eyes and played along.
Oh, yes. As I said, you'll find our work fascinating. I'll deliver Mr. Austin to shore in the morning.
Becker shrugged.
Suit yourself. I've spent enough time at sea to last me a lifetime.
Austin watched the shuttle boat head toward land and turned to the captain. Thanks for rescuing me from Mr. Becker.
Larson sighed heavily.
I suppose bureaucrats like Becker have a value in the scheme of things.
So do the stomach bacteria that aid in digestion, Austin said. The captain laughed and put his hand on Austin's shoulder.
I think a liquid celebration of your successful mission is in order.
I think you're right, Austin said.